session. The Honorable Chief Justice Perry is presiding.
Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. All right, the first matter on calendar this morning, docket numbers 50864, 52615, Lockwood versus State. Council, are you ready to roll?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Council, did you want to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor. With your permission, I'll reserve 5 minutes of my argument for rebuttal. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court, Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Jacob Summer, and I represent Mr. Joshua Lockwood, the appellant in this case. I'm honored to have the opportunity to appear in front of you today. Initially, the Court asked Counsel in a recent order to focus on one primary issue dealing with count two of the convictions in this case. So unless the court wishes me to address the other issues raised in the briefing, I will try to focus my arguments on that issue as it appears that the court has most concern about that.
I'd like you to talk about the other issues in accordance with cumulative error to see if there's cumulative error here.
You would like me to address those, Justice Chair?
Yes.
I can address those briefly, and perhaps I can start with a reference. In that appeal, I would simply say that at trial, there were a total of 8 witnesses called by the state. And of those 8 witnesses, 4 of the witnesses that testified were able to testify in a manner that essentially reiterated the alleged victim's testimony. That is, what they said was exactly the same things that the alleged victim testified to at trial.
Was there a motion in limine in this prior to trial to address that issue?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, there was. The state made that motion 6 days before trial. The defense counsel, or the trial counsel in the case, who is now deceased, he made arguments just before trial began on that motion in limine. So he didn't have a chance to officially respond because it was made so close to the time of trial. But there was a motion in limine. And that motion specifically focused on the testimony of Detectives Mack and Detective Rye, both of which were able to interview the minor child before the trial, during the investigation. And they essentially said the same thing at trial, which is that, you know, the minor child testified that there were certain things done to her. There was no difference in terms of the time, the place, and the incidents. These hearsay incidents, these hearsay testimonies that were presented by the state at trial were essentially allowed to support unfairly the victim's testimony. And I would say that it's important that these witnesses were allowed to testify before the victim even got to the stand. That is, that the victim didn't testify first. She was the last witness. So for whatever reason, all of these witnesses paraded before the jury were able to give all of this testimony that basically said the same thing, hardly any difference at all, and then they were able to put on the alleged victim on the stand and essentially corroborate her testimony. Now, under this court's decision in Felix, that system of essentially parading all these witnesses before the jury does something very detrimental to a defendant accused of these crimes. It unfairly permits the victim to testify a number of times. In this case, a total of 5 times the jury heard this testimony exactly the same. And so, based on this court's findings and holding in Felix, the cumulative hearsay had a significant impact in the outcome of the trial. And I believe that that becomes even more significant as we look at the issues dealing with jury misconduct. Switching now to the issues of jury misconduct, I would say that the facts important to this case are specifically numbers. That is 45, 8, 10, and 0. 45 minutes of research this offending juror did on the internet, at her home, during trial. Approximately 8 internet articles were reviewed by her on the internet. This research that she conducted, which constitutes extrinsic impermissible evidence, was discussed for up to 10 minutes during the jury deliberation. And focusing on the last number, zero, I submit to you that the state presented zero evidence, zero physical evidence, to connect my client with the incidents that are alleged commissions of crime. Zero. The only evidence at trial that was presented that connected my client with these alleged allegations of wrongdoing was the victim's testimony. So you can see now how important the cumulative hearsay problem is in terms of this issue. So the jury foreperson, and I think it's important to note that this individual was the jury foreperson. It's important here because the jury foreperson was voted upon by the other members of the jury, presumably. They obviously thereby thought her of some capacity in terms of her leadership, the ability to direct a conversation, the ability to guide them through the process.
Counsel, as you're talking about this impact, this evidence that she researched, wasn't this evidence that had been put forth already?
Well, that issue was raised, I believe, at some point during the briefing and also in Justice Gibbons' dissent. In the panel decision, the issue about cumulative, whether or not the question
was that previously presented?
You mean the information?
Yes.
Your Honor, I would say no, it was not. In fact, I think the expert, Dr. Wagner, who testified, the only thing that was testified to was that there was no physical evidence to indicate that this individual was the one,
Justice Gibbons had asserted his dissent that 75-90% of child sexual abuse cases reveal no physical evidence of abuse.
And that is correct. I think there was testimony at trial that was indeed the case. The expert
testified about that. So there was testimony at trial, correct?
Yes, that testimony was given at trial. I don't believe it's relevant to the outcome here, though, because when we look at the implications of the research conducted, that is, the offending juror here went home and did research about the implications of an intact hymen.
Counsel, I don't think that any of us would perhaps disagree that there was some misconduct by the independent research. The legal question, however, is what is the reasonable probability that this research affected the outcome? And that's what we need to hear.
Well, my answer to that would be this. The reason why that research affected the outcome on the two counts was because the juror who conducted the research was able to unfairly bolster the victim's testimony. At trial, the jury heard evidence that there was no physical indications that this defendant was the one that committed the crime. And so the only thing that the jury had to decide during deliberation was, do we believe the testimony that was given by the victim? And so what happens is you have a jury who discusses this research finding that supports the story of the victim.
The jury had a
problem. They said, look, if the victim is alleging that there was vaginal penetration in these assaults, but we have a situation where we believe an intact hymen is indicative of no sexual conduct, then what they're doing is they're resolving that problem from the evidence at trial with evidence from without the trial.
But weren't there also indications of trauma regarding the other count?
Yes, there were, Your Honor, but...
So isn't that something the jury could consider as well? There is evidence of trauma.
Yes. The problem with that, though, is that the jury was unable, based on that alone, to say this scarring was done by this individual. So there's no question that there was a problem.
Didn't she testify to that?
I'm sorry?
Did she not testify to that?
The victim did testify to that, and that is the essential problem here, is that she testified to that. The jury had a problem basically reconciling her testimony. Is it true or not? They can't just take and parcel out her testimony and say, well, she was truthful on this but not on this. I mean, what the jury did was essentially just bolstered her entire testimony in favor of the state without the ability of defense counsel to review the evidence, without the ability of the judge to decide whether it was relevant and admissible. And I believe the state made an argument in briefing that was admissible, and I would argue it wouldn't have been. Internet research, internet articles do not constitute admissible evidence unless there's an expert to testify to those.
So on the issue of the impact on the jury verdict,
your argument is that the foreman's research bolstered the victim's credibility.
Exactly. It bolstered the victim's credibility, and that is the central issue here. In this court's case in Zanna, the court found that there was no problem because the internet research conducted by the jury individual was essentially not found at all, and all the jury member did was say, hey, I conducted some research and I didn't find anything. So when viewed in context of the case law, this case deals exactly, almost parallel with the case in Meyer, the facts in Meyer, which essentially prohibit this kind of activity, even though we're talking about maybe different counts here. And I think the panel's decision...
You've argued for a different rule or reconsideration of the rule in Meyer. If you were writing the opinion, how would you reword it, or what rule would you establish?
Your Honor, I don't believe that I'm asking the court to change the opinion in Meyer. In fact, I think that this case is so closely following Meyer in terms of the facts and the rule of law that you don't need to change it at all. Simply just reverse based on the holding in Meyer, and essentially it's consistent therewith. If there's any change at all, I would simply advocate that where we have reliable evidence of actual influence on a jury, as we did in this case, and as was argued in the district court, there should be some reasonable way for our legal system to address where we believe that there's a reliable statement from a jury individual that says, yes, this actually did influence my verdict, as we did in this case.
Was there a jury instruction that said the jury was allowed to disregard the expert testimony if they didn't believe it?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the court instructed the jury in instruction number one that they were not permitted to conduct or to consider anything except for what was presented at trial. But I can't answer the question in terms of the expert testimony.
Well, then not only would the foreperson's research bolster the victim's testimony, but it would also bolster the expert's testimony.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is where I have a problem with the cumulative hearsay, because we have a situation where we've bolstered the victim's testimony, and now we've got four or five other experts on the stand that are testifying exactly the same way. It bolsters the entire case from the state. And so this was done without the ability of defense counsel, as I mentioned, to review the evidence. Mr. Lockwood never saw it. We don't know what was reviewed, whether it was even true or incorrect. And the judge was never able to pass upon whether that information, even from an expert, was admissible. So with that, Your Honors, I'll reserve the remainder of my time unless there are questions.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joseph Reynolds. I'm a deputy district attorney for the Lyon County District Attorney's Office, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Nevada. I could not disagree more with appellant's characterization of the record and his legal arguments. The assertion before this court that there was no physical evidence of sexual assault is incorrect. And I would ask this court to look at the respondent's appendix on pages 172, 174 to 175, 178 and 179, where during trial, five pictures of the victim's anal area were admitted into evidence. Dr. Wagner testified, and so did Nurse Solomon testify, that these pictures revealed tearing and fissures in her anus. Expert testimony was admitted that these could not have been the result of any type of constipation. They were not normal, and that they were a result of an object or in a penis being inserted into her anal cavity. That is physical evidence. To say that there was not physical evidence is not correct. Appellant might be asserting or drawing this distinction there was no DNA evidence, but there was certainly physical evidence of sexual abuse. Three experts testified that their findings were consistent with sexual abuse occurring in this case.
That was as to the one count?
That was, the physical evidence was as to the anal sexual assault count, Chief Justice Perry-Gary.
The juror's research, or the juror foreperson research, as I read the record, applied to the other counts. Would you agree with that, Mr. Reynolds?
I wouldn't go so far, Justice Sata, to say it applied. I say it did, though, deal more with the issue of whether a hymen was intact and whether the existence of a hymen in a young girl precluded sexual assault or sexual abuse.
But doesn't the evidence on one count bolster the evidence on the other count as far as the reliability of the victim's testimony and the expert testimony?
No, it doesn't.
The independent research?
No, it doesn't, Justice Cherry. And the reason it doesn't is that the juror testified, and it's undisputed, that she did her independent research on the first day of trial. The victim in this case did not testify the first day of trial. The victim testified on the second day of trial. So her testimony was not yet even heard before that juror did the research. And the juror testified at issue at the post-verdict evidentiary hearing. She did no research regarding the testimony of the victim in this case.
But she didn't disregard the research. In other words, the victim did testify later on, and this does bolster the victim's testimony.
I think at best, Justice Cherry, it bolstered the evidence in the testimony of Dr. Wagner, who testified in the record that the existence of a hymen does not preclude that a sexual assault occurred. She testified that between 75% and 90% of confirmed sexual assault cases, there isn't any evidence of physical abuse. Nurse Saltman also testified that the victim's hymen was attacked in this case.
But wouldn't it be likely that if they were going to find the defendant guilty of the one count, they'd find him guilty of the other count because of the four persons' independent research?
I think that presumes, Justice Cherry, something that the law doesn't. And it presumes that somehow there's a spillover effect.
But some of us old trial attorneys presume that. I mean, that if they're going to find him guilty of one, they're going to find him guilty of the other.
The law, Justice Cherry, is most recently articulated in Zanna versus State, sets forth the standard where this court is to conduct its analysis. And there's four parts. The first factor is how long the extrinsic research occurred. It occurred between 5 and 10 minutes in this, or the discussion amongst the jurors occurred. It occurred between 5 and 10 minutes was the testimony. There was no evidence that really any discussion occurred. When specifically asked, the juror at issue said, after she revealed her research, no one said anything other than a brief comment about what's the relevance. It is appellant's burden to prove his case to warrant a new trial. There's no evidence that any meaningful discussion amongst the other jurors occurred.
Are you saying this is an error then? There's no error here?
Oh, there was error. I think the issue before this court is the remedy. No doubt that misconduct occurred. Under the second Zanna factor is when did the deliberations occur and when did the misconduct or extrinsic research become revealed? Here there's no evidence that any out-of-court discussions occurred. There's no evidence that any discussion occurred prior to deliberations. It occurred during deliberations. The third factor is the specificity or ambiguity of the information. The existence of whether hymen is intact or not is a piece of neutral, benign, scientific data. It doesn't say that a sexual assault occurred. It doesn't say that a sexual assault did not occur. And in that effect, it did not go to the issue of guilt or innocence. It wasn't material. It didn't bolster the state's case. All it did was say that the state's theory isn't precluded by this piece of physical evidence. And there's a lot of cases of that have been out there where this expert information has been put forth. It did not go to resolve, also contrary to appellant's argument, a conflict in evidence. The defendant put no evidence in the record to contradict the state's expert, Dr. Wagner, regarding this. What it appears that happened is the juror did this research to reconcile her own beliefs, not that of conflicting evidence.
Mr. Reynolds, let me ask you a question. You know, you've got a lot of experience in trial and appellate work and all. Is this independent research thing really bothers me? Because we've had a series of cases cited here, and civil cases as well as criminal. Do you feel it might be necessary for this court to make a strong statement to the district courts as to what instruction should be given to the jury in the opening charge regarding this issue of independent research? Or do you think what's standard in most courts is sufficient right now?
I think with the increasing use of cell phones, computers, texting, a proffered instruction or an elaboration or expansion of the existing instruction to jurors would be beneficial. But jurors are routinely instructed not to conduct any out-of-court research, not to talk to anyone else. The juror disregarded that in this case. And again, I think the issue is what is the remedy? This evidence also was not material because it was cumulative. The jurors had already heard from Dr. Wagner what the independent juror confirmed, that the existence of a hymen doesn't preclude sexual assault and sexual abuse.
Well, as Justice Cherry had indicated a little earlier, isn't that one of the problems in this case is the cumulative nature of the hearsay testimony on top of everything else?
Justice Perry-Gary, under NRS, and this is the second issue that was originally briefed on appeal, under NRS 51-385, permits the admission of child hearsay statements in sexual assault cases. And this court has articulated that it can do so and it's proper to do so when three criteria are met.
First, but I think the indication was you had numerous witnesses testifying about the same thing, and the cumulative nature of that was prejudicial.
The reliance on the appellant for his argument is Felix, where this court, in its 1993 case, Felix is an albatross, and I think an anomaly factually in and of itself, where 98 pretrial interviews were conducted, and one of the victims in the case didn't testify at all at trial. And the other one, the problem was, is that after her testimony, the state introduced statements under 51-385 and did not afford the defendant an opportunity to cross-examine. Here, that didn't happen. These statements came in before the victim testified in this case. And what that afforded and why this case is distinguishable from Felix is that it afforded the defense a full opportunity to cross-examine the victim on all these statements. And if this court looks at each of those four statements individually, with respect to Detective Mack, there was no objection. With respect to the testimony of Sergeant Sherry Rye, there was an objection that it was cumulative. Those are the first two witnesses the defendant complains of. The other two is Nurse Solomon and Dr. Lippert. No objection with respect to either of those two witnesses' testimony. So first of all, the state's assertion and argument in the brief was this wasn't properly preserved for appellate review. The defendant states in his opening brief that he is not raising an issue with respect to Dr. Lippert and Nurse Solomon's testimony. Yet at the same time, he's arguing before this court somehow that the testimony is unnecessarily cumulative based upon these four witnesses. With respect to Dr. Lippert's testimony and Nurse Solomon's testimony, it was alternatively admissible under NRS 51-115 as the medical, under the medical exception to the hearsay rule. Though that information was revealed to Nurse Solomon during her CARES exam, it was necessary to explain to the jury why she conducted the CARES exam in the way that she did. Dr. Lippert's revelations of the victim's testimony in recounting to her were necessary to discuss her psychological evaluation of the victim. And while the nucleus of each of these four witnesses does overlap as far as some information, they also elaborated on different aspects of the testimony, which under this court's statements in Felix said it was proper to do. And that's the whole purpose of the hearsay exception to child victim statements, is that these cases are special in nature. There are special evidentiary rules apply. And under the three-factor test, which required a pretrial trustworthiness hearing, that hearing did occur. Both counsel argued. While the victim didn't testify at the hearing, this court has said in Bronstein versus State that that is harmless when the victim later testifies at trial, which she did. Under the statute, the second prong requires that she be less than 10 years old. Undisputably, she was. And the third factor is whether her statements have guarantees of trustworthiness. One of those factors that they look to guarantees of trustworthiness is whether she had a motive to fabricate. There's no motive to fabricate by this victim. Actually, the testimony was that she the defendant.
Counsel, fundamentally, we're sitting up here today and we're listening to this, and it keeps running across my mind that the axiom that due process requires a fair trial. It doesn't require a perfect trial, but it requires a fair trial. In this case, and to use the vernacular of one of the movies, we have a runaway juror. Where is the line between the trial that's not perfect and a fair trial from your standpoint?
Well, this court, there's a case-by-case analysis. In Felix, for example, regarding the cumulative hearsay statements, the court said six times where the victim's statements came in and an additional seventh time where the child testified may be too much. Yet in Pantano versus State, which is a 2006 opinion, the court said three times was okay. Here, the argument is that there was four times and an additional time by the victim. This court has to look at that in the rubric of the totality of the evidence. And here, there was overwhelming evidence of guilt. There was physical evidence that she was sexually assaulted anally. There was three experts who evaluated her and believed her testimony and her statements were consistent with sexual abuse. She testified clearly on the stand that he assaulted her with his penis anally, orally, vaginally. The testimony that the jury heard was he did it on Sundays, why he's supposed to be taking this victim to church, and that he gave her a choice on how she wanted to be assaulted. She testified that she chose anal assault and oral assault because it hurt the least.
I have a question. On the juror misconduct, aside from the credibility buttressing issue that your opponent raises, is there any evidence that the internet research that the foreperson of the jury performed turned up any information beyond that which was already before the jury? In other words, is there anything new in the way of extrinsic evidence that was imported into that jury room by virtue of that internet research?
If I may respond, Justice Pickering, no. And not only that, is there was absolutely no way, it is physiologically impossible, that internet research regarding whether an intact hymen precluded sexual abuse could have affected the anal sexual assault count. The juror specifically testified she did no research regarding the anal sexual assault count. None. There's no way to say reasonably that it is related, and that those two are related. And if this court is inclined not to affirm all three counts, the state asks this court to at least, at a minimum, affirm count two, the anal sexual assault count.
Chief, I have a question, if I may.
Sure.
I'd like to return to the discussion regarding Felix and the admission of evidence by witnesses repeating the statements of the child victim in this case. We have made it clear that the district court is required to make specific findings regarding circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness. And it is asserted that the district court did not make those findings in this case. In Felix, there's a comment contained in the opinion which says, we will decline to make that determination on appeal unless the factual determination is obvious. Would we have in the record facts which would enable us to make that circumstantial guarantee of trustworthiness?
Yes.
And if so, what are they?
Yes, the answer is yes, Justice Hardesty. And when we're looking at those factors as far as trustworthiness, one of the things this court also said in Felix was to look to the continuity of the statements of the victim at the first inception of when the abuse was revealed and how, whether they were consistent over time. This court says that in Felix. If this court were to look at the statements that were made, they were extraordinarily consistent. Dr. Lippert testified on behalf of the state that they were remarkably consistent. Dr. Lippert testified on behalf of the state, and so did Lyon County Sheriff Sergeant Sherry Rye, that this child's understanding of sexual terminology was beyond anything a child of her age would ever know, even if they were exposed to pornography. She described what happened to her in graphic detail. The other, again, one of the factors the court looks for is motive to fabricate. There was no motive for this victim to fabricate. Again, the evidence was that she loved the defendant, considered him like a father. Those two factors show that there was an extraordinarily guarantee of reliability that this court can, in hindsight, look to evaluate the trustworthiness of her statement. And along those lines, what the district court did say, and this is important, is during that initial pretrial hearing that the defense could renew its objection and could re-argue the issue as to whether they considered any evidence improperly cumulative, which distinguishes it from, for example, Richmond, when this court looked to whether an issue was properly preserved for appellate review. The district court in this case allowed defense expressly on the record the opportunity to renew their objection, to revisit the issue. The defense did not. They only objected to one of those four witnesses' testimony as being cumulative, and that was the second one, Lyon County Sheriff Sergeant Rye. The others, they let go, and specifically in their opening brief, they maintain that they are not challenging the testimony of Dr. Lippert and Nurse Solomon. I believe it's on page 9 of their opening brief, where they clearly state that.
All right, colleagues, any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Three minutes is not a lot of time. I'll try to hurry through some of the notes that I've taken. Justice Pickering, I want to comment on the question that you had asked earlier about the new evidence. Opposing counsel indicated that there was no new evidence, and I would disagree wholeheartedly with that assertion. While it's clear that the expert did testify that there is oftentimes no physical evidence to indicate assault in victims of sexual assault, there was no testimony at all about the implications of an intact hymen. There was testimony that the minor child had an intact hymen, but there was no testimony, absolutely none, about the implications of what that means. And that is what the jury misconduct causes such a problem for, because it was new evidence outside of the issues presented at trial, and it wasn't something that could be considered. So that was absolutely new evidence. No discussion about the implications of
could you explain to me then how you square up what you just said with the testimony that I understand the expert gave, that in 75% to 90% of child sexual abuse cases, you will find an intact hymen?
No, actually, the testimony was that in 75% to 90% of cases, there will be no evidence of there will be no physical evidence of trauma, or actually, the word trauma wasn't used, but no physical evidence. There was no indication that that meant DNA evidence. There was no indication that meant scarring. There was no discussion about it. So that was all. They just said there were, in those percentage of cases, no physical evidence. End of story. So it didn't go into the implications of an intact hymen, and that's what the problem was with the research. And that's why the discussion with the jury during deliberations was a problem. I want to talk about the Felix issue because in Felix, this court's language was specifically this, and I quote, "Once the child's accusations have been fairly presented by one or more witnesses as to the time, place, and incident, and any challenges to the victim's credibility are fairly met, additional hearsay allegations should be restricted." So we don't have a problem that some hearsay evidence can come in, because clearly under the statute 51384, I believe it is, there are some reasons why the legislature has said we need to have these things. But in Felix, that was modified to say, look, you can do that, but you can't do it too much. And that's our argument, specifically with the testimony as to Detectives Mack and Rye. Their testimony was exactly the same. Each detective reviewed the tapes of the others. It was exactly the same. So that's why we believe it's cumulative hearsay. Now, I know counsel said that he couldn't disagree more about the issue of physical evidence, but I think he misheard what I said something of that nature. What I actually said was there was no physical evidence presented at trial that connected my client with this crime. There's not a question that there was physical evidence that there had been something that was going on, perhaps even physical abuse. But may I finish,
Chief? Yes.
In terms of the evidence presented at trial, the issue about physical evidence was important because it didn't connect my client with that. The only evidence that connected my client with those allegations was the victim's testimony. That is why we have such a problem in this case. And that is why...
Isn't that the case with most of these sexual assault cases?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that the case with most of these sexual assault cases?
That there's no other evidence?
Right.
Well, I couldn't speak for most other cases, but I think I could say that there is, given the expert testimony, there's a reasonable probability that in many cases there's not going to be any corroborating physical evidence. So in terms of the actual physical evidence and what's presented at trial, it may not be something that is, we're not going to have DNA in every case, and we're not going to have those things. That's what the expert testified to. But that goes to the issue that we have in this case, which is the victim's credibility. And that's all the jury had to work with. Was the victim credible? And I think that's important. If there are questions, I can answer
one question. All right, Justice Hardesty. Could you respond to counsel's argument that you are not able to make the cumulative argument you're making here because you didn't make objections to Dr. Libert, the nurse, and the other officer, only Sergeant Rye?
Your Honor, my response to that is simply that we are not contesting that the doctors Lippert and Solomon, I believe it was, those two incidents are fair in terms of the ability for the court to admit them. The reason why we didn't object is essentially there was it wasn't preserved. Trial counsel didn't preserve the issue for appeal. What he did do, though, was object based on Mack and Rye's testimony, based on the motion in limine filed 6 days before trial. That's how I am. The only reason I'm able to argue that today is because that was preserved by his objection in that motion hearing.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you both for your briefing in this case and your arguments. And the case will stand submitted. We'll give you